Session number 6058, reel 7.
Did the Japanese ever attempt to make the POWs make propaganda for them?
I think the answer to that is no, apart from the situation I described earlier, where we had to parade through the streets of Pusan. After our arrival in Mukden, of course, we were very isolated, and this was no longer possible, this sort of public exhibition type thing. There was an occasion when broadcasts to our people at home, and we received this invitation with very considerable suspicion, and wanted to know what it was to be all about. And questions were asked by our senior British and American officers, and the Japanese gave assurances that there were no propaganda motives behind the thing in the direct sense, except that they wanted people to know that the Japanese were looking after their prisoners. So, with the approval of British and American, senior British and American officers, people who chose to were allowed to make a broadcast home. The broadcast were made from a written script which was approved by the British and American officers and the Japanese commandant, of course. And I myself, I did make a short broadcast just to my parents so that I was alive and well. I deliberately mentioned the names of some neighbours so that my parents would know it was authentic, and a couple of little points like that which would identify me to them. But obviously it contained no propaganda, and we were all extremely dubious about whether the messages would even arrive home. But after my release and my after my arrival home, my mother showed me a very mixed up message, a copy of a message which she had received from the British Red Cross, with a story to the effect that it had been picked up by a ship at sea belonging to some neutral country, I think. It had been in a very garbled form, as I say, and but whoever picked it up obviously realised what it was intended to be, and had passed the messages on to the British Red Cross, and so in one way or another it did arrive home, and as far as I know it did not appear to have any propaganda content or serve any purpose for the Japanese.
What type of spare time activities did the POWs have?
Well, of course, there were none in the strict sense of the word, because we were kept inside the barracks. After our evening meal, we were not allowed outdoors. Mostly card playing in one form or another, and such little things, sing songs and whatever people could organise amongst themselves. And one of the things which I recall very vividly is the way, the big way in which the Americans particularly went in for poker playing. It was very obvious that a situation arose where the people who ran these poker schools assumed the authority of a poker baron, one might almost say. Enormous sums of money were exchanged, and I still don't know exactly how the money was obtained, because the Japanese paid us a few yen a month. If I remember right, it was about 4 yen a month, and we didn't even receive that every month. There were long intervals when we received nothing at all. I think a certain amount of black marketing went on in the working parties in the factories between the prisoners and the Manchus, the Chinese who worked there. I can't imagine what the prisoners had to sell, because there was nothing that I could think of as being particularly worth bartering with from the camp. But one way or another, large sums of money did appear, and they were exchanged in these highly organized poker games. They were illegal, of course, and not permitted by the Japanese, but they were sufficiently organized for the people to be able to pay lookouts at the entrances to the barracks and so on, so that the approach of a guard could be noticed, and the school would be broken up before he arrived. I became very adept at playing bridge and cribbage, and like most situations where British army personnel are concerned, we had our own little groups of friends and particular mates and so on, and we used to get ourselves together and say bridge, poker, and just general chat and so on. Was the cribbage. I still don't know how to play poker myself, quite honestly. And such pastimes as we could think up.
As a result of this gambling, did any POWs become indebted?
Yes, this was one of the unfortunate situations, in a sense, that this hierarchy did emerge, whereas the people who ran the schools and had all the money and put themselves in a position of considerable power and authority had other prisoners doing their work for them. They do their night guard pickets and even mortgage their rations, the little loaves, the bread rolls, which I mentioned were an obvious form of barter. One roll could be the equivalent of so many Japanese yen. But of course, there were those who mortgaged their future and their future rations and anything else that they could produce to raise money for their debts, arrived at by playing poker.
Did any suicides or attempted suicides occur?
Yes, there were two incidents which I recall. I really don't know whether either of them was a serious attempt at suicide or simply a cry for help. In one case, one of the British, which is rather remarkable because, as I say, the poker schools were predominantly American, but this British lad had got himself involved, and he in fact tried to hang himself, but when he was discovered, he was calling out and both his feet were still touching the ground, and there was some scepticism about whether it had been a serious attempt or just a cry for help. Another case, someone tried to slash his wrists, but slashed them in the wrong place, and no great harm was done.
So the chap who hanged himself had been involved in indebtedness?
Yes, he was in very serious debt, and he was under a lot of duress and threats from the people that he'd been involved with, and probably also not having very much to eat, having bartered his food, and would be in a pretty desperate situation, I suspect.
Do Did you ever think that the Japanese might win the war?
Well, oddly enough, and it does seem ludicrous in retrospect, but the idea of the Japanese winning the war never even occurred to me. I was absolutely, totally and utterly confident that we would win. This was not in the later stages. This was even from the time immediately after we'd been taken prisoner in Singapore, when things were truly desperate.
Did the camp in which you were in ever receive any POWs from any other camps?
Yes, toward the end of the war, during the last 3 months, I suppose, or thereabouts, 3 or 4 months, the prisoners did start to arrive in large numbers from all kinds of odd-sounding places in the Pacific Islands. And it was there that we learned that things were really being rolled up. Obviously, the Americans advancing through the islands of the Pacific were causing the Japanese to evacuate them. And the people who arrived with us were, in fact, they seemed to be the more senior officers from the British, American and Dutch forces who had been imprisoned in these other places and in these other prison camps. So we had a very top-heavy situation where we had large numbers of the top brass occupying a considerable amount of our the space which we had at our disposal.
How did their physical condition compare with yours?
Pretty much the same, generally, so far as I recall. But as I say, I suspect that many of them, I really don't know, but perhaps had been a wee bit protected by their rank and would be in a better physical condition than perhaps other ranks who'd had to work at more difficult tasks and experienced more hardship. But they were not too bad. We did receive, we had to put several fairly high-ranking officers into hospital, I recall, and I remember one American colonel especially who died not very long after his arrival.
Did you ever suspect that the Japanese might want to wipe out the POWs?
Yes, well, this was a constant threat, of course. We, especially when we had fairly convincing evidence that they were starting to lose the war, we never quite had the we never knew quite how they'd accept a possible defeat, and well, we obviously had to be prepared for the worst. But at the same time, I tried to convince myself, at least, that it wouldn't happen.
I think that you mentioned on a previous occasion that there was some digging of pits, which you thought might be for you.
Yes, but here again, this, as far as I'm concerned, was a hearsay. I had a very close friend who told me that he had been involved in a working party digging mass graves on the outside of the wall of the camp. Now, I have no reason to suppose that he wasn't telling the truth. He was a man of very great integrity, and I do believe him. At present, he's living in Australia, so I haven't been in close contact with him for many years, but he said that was the case, but I can only quote, and I have no hard evidence, not having seen the actual graves which were being dug.
Did you suffer from Allied bombing?
Yes, this was one of the, during the last few months of the war, although at the time we didn't know it was the last few months. But we did have constant air raid warnings. The Americans were obviously penetrating further and further into the area around Mukden, and we had several near misses. And on one occasion, the camp itself, by some tremendous ill luck or oversight, was accidentally bombed. It was straddled by bombs from an American plane. I should say that this particular plane was one of a large number, I'd say 20-odd, B-29s, which overflew us, and it was a very, very clear day, beautiful blue skies. It was during the winter, the air was very clear. The planes were at a tremendous height and could only just be identified. They were being attacked by Japanese aircraft, and they overflew the camp, which was located in a very wide, featureless expanse of empty, barren countryside. The only landmark of any note was a large factory about a mile away from the camp, or perhaps less than a mile. But it was a very modern Japanese arms factory. It had a flat roof, and it had a couple of anti-aircraft guns mounted on the roof. And it really was a wonderful example of accurate bombing, because as these American planes overflew us, we heard the bombs falling, and the Japanese factory simply disappeared from the face of the earth. There was absolutely nothing left standing of the building after the last of the planes had disappeared. And we thought this was great, of course, and we were sort of starting to jump around. I should say that we had no air raid protection. There was nowhere to shelter, and people just had to... In fact, we were advised by the Japanese to gather in the centre of the main parade ground, in the centre of the barracks, which most people did. I was in this hospital building, and I could observe from the window. So this is where most of the camp personnel were, outdoors. And after this wonderful example of accuracy and target bombing, as we were congratulating ourselves and so on, another single American plane came along after the main flight. It was obviously in trouble. It was being attacked, and we heard another stick of bombs falling, and unfortunately these bombs did straddle the camp, and they did a tremendous amount of damage, and we had a considerable number of dead and wounded amongst the prisoners. I think the total numbers were something in the order of 100 casualties, of which about 20-odd died.
Can you describe to me the circumstances under which you came to be released?
Well, yes, this really is something which almost rivals the James Bond incident, suppose that again we were expecting the end of the war to arrive sometime in the not too distant future, because of the arrival of all the extra people in the camp and the news that we'd received and so forth. We had heard of the explosion of some kind of super bomb, which we didn't identify as an atom bomb because we'd never heard of such a thing, on the mainland of Japan. And we also heard that the Russians had declared war on Japan. So one day, again a very fine clear day, this was during the summer in August, some American planes gave a warning, and As usual, we were expecting it was a raid, and however, we saw a large number of parachutes descending. Now, it was very difficult to come to any conclusion as to what they might be. My first reaction was that they were paratroops of some kind, possibly Russian, and that we were likely to be in the centre of a shootout between the paratroops and the local Japanese garrison. But however, the parachutes descended and we heard absolutely nothing further. This was during the course of the day, and when nightfall came and we had to, it was reveille, it was lights out, and we tried to, we were back in the barracks and tried to get off to sleep, but there was tremendous excitement. Obviously something big was happening, nobody knew quite what, and then we were rather astounded when the Japanese guards came around unarmed and handing out cigarettes and trying to be very friendly, and obviously this could only be good news. So very, very few of us had any sleep that night. There was a tremendous excitement in the barracks and a lot of speculation. But it wasn't until about midday on the following day that we were asked to assemble in the barrack square again. And there, to our surprise, were a number of soldiers dressed in American uniforms, fully armed, and obviously waiting to have our attention. It turned out that these people were American paratroops who had been flown in for the express purpose of taking control of the camp. The war had ended. The Japanese emperor had broadcast his imperial rescript and ordered his troops to surrender their arms and so forth, but of course there was always the possibility that some of the outlying places might ignore it. And I think it was in view of this possibility that the Americans had decided to send in these people to secure the camp, and presumably largely because of the presence of these very high-ranking American and perhaps British officers who were with us. So this was how we were told of the end of the war, and it was so utterly novel and unexpected that it took quite a while for the good news to sink in. And, in fact, I don't think there was all that much expressed excitement. I think we just all heaved an enormous sigh of relief, and it took us quite a considerable time to react.
So what happened next?
We were informed by the this American major, who was the platoon commander of this of the paratroops who had dropped in. We were told that the war had ended, that the Japanese had surrendered unconditionally, and that we would be freed, but unfortunately he was not in a position to do a great deal about it other than make sure that we were being taken care of. They brought along with them enormous quantities of American weapons, rifles, carbines, machine pistols, light automatic weapons, mortars, which accounted for the large number of parachutes that we'd noticed. So they were on hand, presumably to arm us with if the occasion arose. But he pointed out that as the area was to be a Russian zone of occupation, that we could not be officially released until the Russians arrived at some time in the future and released us officially. In the meantime, we could regard ourselves as being free, except we had to remain in the confines of the camp. The Japanese guards and the officers, the camp staff, were kept in their quarters under open arrest, and in fact were being guarded at that time by the prisoners, which was quite a reversal in fortunes. Well, to the best of my knowledge, there was no abuse of the guards. I think everyone was very well behaved, and we simply had to wait then for the Russians to make the next move. In the meantime, the American paratroops. Who had come along, and they'd brought a Japanese, an American Japanese with them, who was a skilled interpreter. And they did all the documentation. They got all our names together and who we were, where we were from. They did a very good job at getting us organized and in a situation where we could obviously move out quickly and under some kind of control if the occasion arose.
Did the Americans get any supplies to you in the way of food?
Well, yes. This, again, they did in a typically American style, in a very big way. Once our location was known, it was obviously transmitted to the American Army Command, and I think they were located in Guam as the nearest headquarters. And within 24, perhaps 48 hours, we had enormous numbers of flying fortresses flying at very low level over the camp and dropping enormous amounts of American food and clothing, equipment, material of every conceivable kind.